Well, hello. You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Joshua Molina.
And I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. Today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 19 of The West Wing, Let Bartlett Be Bartlett. And coming up later, the United States Undersecretary of the Army, the Honorable Patrick Murphy, is going to be joining us to talk about this episode.
It first aired on April 26th, 2000. The story is by Peter Parnell and Patrick Cadell, which rhymes, and that's cute. The teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin, and the episode was directed by Laura Innes, whom you know as an actor from her work as Carrie Weaver in 249 episodes of ER, and all sorts of other things.
Part of the John Wells family, then.
That is true. I have a Laura Innes directs anecdote.
From a later episode.
Yes. It's not a spoiler of any kind, except that I'll probably tell the story again 2 years from now when we get to it.
Sure. Let's hear it.
Okay. So she directed an episode that I acted in seasons after this one, and she's a very serious director, and I'm a not very serious actor. And so Laura came up to discuss a scene we were about to shoot, and she had really thought it through, all the different beats and psychologically where the characters were at. And she kind of talked me through it and said, this is my take, and I think what you're thinking here is this. And that sort of reflects on, remember what happened, you know, last season, and I think what you're trying to accomplish here, and this and that. She kind of gave a 5-minute spiel. And then I said, so bottom line, happy face or sad face? And I just saw the blood drain out of her face. She was not amused by what I thought, what I meant to be, just a light joke. And she kind of just walked away like, oh, okay, that's who you are. I was going, I thought, for just a small laugh, but she looked really, really disappointed in who I was as a person and an actor.
Oh, maybe that's why she isn't joining us for this episode.
Maybe. Yeah, I was too scared to ask. But she's a fine director, is really what I'm trying to say. And I like to apologize for things indirectly 12 years later. And so let this stand as an apology to Laura Innes.
She's going to go on to direct a bunch of episodes of The West Wing, but this is her first. And I read a story that I will get to later about her and her directing style, too. But first, let me give you a little synopsis of the episode.
Now, are we going to get Rishi version or NBC version?
This is the Rishi version. Here it is. 4 points. There's a memo going around. It's a strategic outline about how to beat the Bartlett administration in an election, and it breaks down all the weaknesses of the staff and the president. And it turns out it was written by Mandy, and Danny Kincannon has it. Sam and Toby have a meeting about Don't Ask, Don't Tell with some members of the military and Congress. Two members of the Federal Election Commission resign, and the president asks Josh to look into bucking the traditional appointment routine and putting two of their handpicked reformers on instead. And Leo and the president, triggered by Mandy's memo, get into it over the political compromises they've had to make and who's to blame for losing sight of their original loftier goals.
Very nicely done. Bullet points.
We're getting towards the end of season one here. This is episode 19. We only have 22 episodes in the first season, but this is a really good one. I think now we've come far enough along to say safely, this is one of the best episodes of the season.
In fact, I'm going to go even further, and I usually don't play this game because I often don't even know my own heart enough to pick favorites of anything, but this is thus far my favorite episode of the season.
Awesome. I am down with that. In the previously on, we get kind of a highlight reel. It's really a low light reel. It's the worst moments of, the most painful moments of the Bartlett administration. We often talk about compromises that they have to make or ways that they have to let go of their ideals for political expediency. And we get a little compilation of some of those worst moments in the previously on.
Yes, it would have been appropriate to have Tom Bergeron host the previously on. Clearly not a fan of America's funniest home videos.
America's least funny home videos.
The Bartlett's least funny administration moments. Mm-hmm. I was disappointed, though, that no one took it in the nuts.
Only metaphorically.
Right. How about the cold opening? It's a near perfect cold opening, I think.
What more do you want from it, Josh? T- to make it perfect.
I want nothing more. Okay, it's perfect.
Even before we get into the real meat of the episode, you get the sense that this is not a well-oiled machine. I think that's one thing that I thought was so impeccably done in this episode is there's a lot of grinding of gears. You know, it feels like things are out of tune and out of sync. And it seems like it would be hard enough to write something and direct something that makes it seem like everything is working perfectly. But to be able to make it work perfectly to show how it's not working perfectly seems even harder. I thought it was really impressive.
Well said. And the characters also are aware of the fact that they're not a Swiss timepiece. And I think ultimately that's why the memo really gets under the skin of everybody, because it's just a mirror being held up to them. And it's not revelatory. It's just rough to read it in print.
Right. But the very first example of this is just Sam being out of sync with the weather report and the speech. He has to change a line in case it rains. The speech is going to get moved indoors.
It's not going to rain till later today.
If it rains, please remember to change the opening line.
It's not going to rain till 1, maybe 2 o'clock.
Yeah, but if you're wrong, you got to change the opening line.
And the whole time he's like confident that even if he doesn't make the change, the president, being a smart guy and an observant guy, isn't going to just screw it up even if he has it wrong on the page. But of course, the president gets distracted as well for other reasons. And so by the time he actually delivers it, he blows the line.
Yeah, and I love the writing here because so much of the time, Aaron Sorkin is one or two steps ahead of the audience. But here, he lets you get in front of him. You know what's going to happen.
Right.
You kind of know what's going to happen with the weather. And you kind of know that the first line of the speech is not going to go well. But it's all that much funnier and more satisfying because it's kind of a wait for it. And then just the way he delivers. So even when he lets you in those rare moments get one half a step in front of him, he delivers in a really grand way.
Yeah. I mean, Leo totally telegraphs it too, where they start to talk about, they find out about the two members of the FEC retiring, and the president gets this like twinkle in his eye and he's like, oh, let's dangle our feet in the water. And Leo even says before he goes in to deliver it, he says,
you're going to concentrate on this now? Is your head going to be in changing the nature of democracy?
No, I'm definitely going to be thinking about the trout fishermen, Leo, because that's where my focus should be.
And so Sam's initial idea that the president will be on it, we already know he's off his game. This isn't going to happen.
Absolutely. He's completely teeing it up.
Yeah.
It's a beauty to watch.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's good to see you. Thank you.
Sam?
Damn it.
What? I forgot to do something.
As I look out over this magnificent vista.
So we've talked about how Mandy hasn't quite clicked with the team, and she was even missing completely for a couple episodes.
What has Mandy ultimately done wrong? Other than, I mean, there's a reference in her subplot from Josh to a burn bag, and
right.
She has clearly made a bad security mistake, but she is, I think, a little bit mistreated in terms of just the existence of this opposition research memo that, of course, she's written. She's treated as if having written this memorandum, when she was, in fact, working for someone else, that is sort of an egregious betrayal.
I think it's less that the memo was written and more that it got out there, right?
Well, I think ultimately that's how it's treated. But at first in the scene with CJ, I got the feeling that CJ was treating Mandy as if she, having written this was a misstep. I'm like, how could you?
It crystallizes in the scene between Danny and CJ. Danny really, once again, is sort of the voice of reason and clarity. And when he and CJ are yelling at each other, he really boils it down when he says,
Mandy's letter was a pretty accurate analysis, and you know it. You knew she was working for Russell, and you knew why. You knew she had to have written a memo. Why wasn't it the first thing you asked for when you hired her? Mandy, tell us everything you think we're doing wrong, because you knew what she was going to say. You knew she was right. You knew there was nothing you could do about it.
So you didn't want to look, you know, face the truths of what would be in this memo. And that's why you're all really upset, is because it's telling you something that you already fear is true.
Yeah, and that proves to be the case. I mean, ultimately, the airing of this private memo is the inciting action that we've been waiting for the entire season to wake up and shake up the administration and the senior staff and prompt them into or aggressively pursuing an agenda.
After the credits, by the way, we get a classic Teledonna setup. Josh and Donna are walking and talking, and Donna asks,
how does the FEC work?
Six commissioners are appointed for a six-year term.
Overlap.
Two seats come up every 2 years.
And two commissioners just resigned?
At the same time.
How many times has that happened?
Including this time?
Yeah.
Once.
So the president has the opportunity to stack the FEC with our people and make a measurable impact on campaign finance reform?
Yes.
Well, yeah. Do it, baby.
I certainly needed it. My depth of knowledge on the FEC was slight, thin. Somebody pointed out on our message board, on our website, that we are using the term Teledonna at times to refer to exposition shared with the audience through Josh's explanation of something to Donna. And this listener pointed out that her name is actually Donatella. In other words, the listener kind of didn't get that that's why we call it Teledonna.
Right.
I thought that was cute.
I liked on Twitter when you were recently trying to explain to people about not joking the joke. Could you explain that for people?
So here's an example. I tweeted, don't know a thing about Scandal season 6 storylines, so I have no idea what shape to show up in. Hope buff and impossibly handsome works. Okay, people, the joke here is, I'm not so buff, and I'm not at all handsome.
I would disagree with both of those, but I get the joke.
In truth, I am kind of buff.
You are.
But ugly. But anyway, so somebody writes to me, by buff, do you mean big, ugly, fat f***er? That's joking the joke.
Not even well. There's nothing like,
right.
If you were going to restate your joke and have it be funny, that would be one thing, but that's not funny.
Well, exactly. There's nothing wrong with, look, in comedy writing, anytime you can beat or top or improve a joke, that is welcome. But a less funny restating of a joke is joking the joke, which is why I responded to this guy, no, I meant ripped, muscular.
Very good. In 20 Hours in L.A., we talked about Bob Balaban's character, Ted Marcus, and you said that it reminded you that you thought the name might be derived from Ted Marcoux, who was a Sorkin player. And here he is in The West Wing.
Yes.
I got excited when I saw his name. I said, oh, yeah, there he is.
That's Ted Marcoux, exactly. He played Lieutenant Kendrick in the original Broadway production and Out of Town of A Few Good Men. Great actor.
And now he plays another member of the military in this episode.
Yes, Aaron has him pegged for, I guess, intolerant, unevolved members of the military.
You know, despite what I said about the team not being well-oiled, not being a well-oiled machine, at the beginning of the episode, CJ, before she gets derailed by Mandy's memo, is kind of killing it in the briefing room. She's got some great jokes. I love this line. I think about it all the time.
The theme of this year's event is learning is delightful and delicious, as, by the way, am I.
And then she talks about the people from the American Egg Board.
And I've hung with some of the cats from the American Egg Board, and they are party people.
She's got some jokes, and everybody's eating it up. I don't know. It just seems like she's in her element, and she's in a good mood. And then suddenly, Mandy ruins all of that.
CJ's press conferences often go very well until she learns about that thing she didn't know about.
Right. That's true. And then we get into, I think this is really the first time we're getting an exploration of Margaret and who she is.
Major, major Margaret episode.
Yeah. Previously, I think that she'd been portrayed as a caring and capable assistant to Leo. But here we find out that she's actually pretty quirky.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it was hinted at, but here it's like really blow it up.
She's got a near OCD level fixation with the caloric content of the White House mess hall's raisin muffin.
But mainly because it seems to have messed up the email system within the White House.
Yes. I also like that in a throwaway line, Admiral Fitzwalla says, oh, the White House computers aren't secure.
Right. My favorite, I think, of the Leo moments is when she's first talking to Leo about this, about the her friend Lynette and the muffin.
Anyway, she sent me an email about the actual calorie count in the raisin muffins they're serving in the mess. I forwarded the email to several hundred secretaries and assistants at OEOB and in the West Wing, and that was fine. But Jolene Millman, who works in political liaison, then hit reply, which apparently...
Oh, Margaret, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to...
I hung in there as long as I could, but you long since passed the point when I stopped caring.
It's the kind of thing I wish I could say so often in life, but politeness forbids me. For such a bummer of an episode, I think I laughed quite a bit.
Yeah, there are some funny bits. Josh and Donna are really like boyfriend and girlfriend in this episode.
Yeah.
In a way that kind of annoyed me. Not annoyed with the writing or anything, but just like their relationship is a little annoying. It's very unprofessional. And I know, again, this is going to think Josh and Donna lovers everywhere will assail me for. But I want to go, just be professional. Just tell her what you need and then why don't you just go do it? She's really like a kind of like a wounded girlfriend, and he gets his back up and he's kind of defensive and then he apologizes. And I'm like, just do your jobs.
I really liked the scene between them when she gives him the information on English as the national language.
6 pages on English as the national language.
Is it good?
I gave you some good stuff on James Madison and the tyranny.
James Madison?
And the tyranny in the
middle. That's for a damn social studies paper. I wanted...
Don't snap at me, Josh.
Donna.
Look at the memo. I gave you what you asked for. Don't snap at me.
I was like, yeah, go Donna.
I'm going to have to fight you on that.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's just like, just... give him the thing and I don't know. Their relationship is starting to bug me.
but then she has this line.
Why is everyone walking around like they know they've already lost?
If the whole episode can be encapsulated in one line of dialogue, I think it's that this one.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, that's the little key in that the White House staff needs to get their groove back. And that's what this episode really is all about.
But I totally, completely agree. Very unprofessional. I think the reason why I thought it felt so authentically like a boyfriend and girlfriend relationship is the reason why you're...
Yeah, no, I agree. It's less cringy, but there's a similar thing going on with CJ and Danny.
Yeah.
And that's unprofessional in its way, too. And did CJ really think Danny was going to give her the information she needed? Or actually, he does give her the information. He says, I'm the one who has the paper. I've got the memorandum. But did she really think that she's going to talk him out of writing about it, reporting it?
Yeah. I love before they actually get into that part when she's just, CJ's waiting to talk to Danny. And she keeps trying to interrupt him from while he's typing.
Danny, I wanted to ask. Danny, is it the Magna Carta?
I'm trying to finish the thought here.
Go ahead.
I'm finished.
Yeah, that's another one of those moments. I mean, it works perfectly for the characters involved, but, you know, Aaron as a writer, I have the feeling, I can see him wanting to try to get something down and saying to somebody, hang on, and then losing it. It's just a classic little Aaron twist that I suspect comes from his personal life.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. That's something he'd probably gone through. I was thinking about how much I loved that because it felt so real and also in some ways was kind of an unnecessary scene or like an unnecessary part to that scene.
Huh.
You know, I think in a lesser show, you just cut straight to the action of CJ comes in and they have their dialogue and they confront each other. But this part of her walking in and saying Danny and he says, hold on. Danny, hang on. And then he's trying to finish a thought. Like there's, you know, there's a minute devoted to her not being able to get his attention. And it's a great, authentic feeling interaction. But I had written down, I was like, I love that, but what's it for? And I think you're right. I think it's probably Aaron describing something that actually really happens to him.
Yeah. And also I think in its way, now that it didn't occur to me as I watched, but now that you frame it this way, it also has the extra weight of showing us who Danny is. We get him in, you know, a lot of him either asking a quick question in a press conference or visiting CJ in her office for other purposes. But this is the guy. He's the guy who sits there in the dim light and cranks out, you know, great articles. And he's a writer and this is who he is. And so it kind of, in a very cute little way, also grounds us in, this is why he's also not the guy who's going to, for reasons of love or romance, hold back on reporting about this memo because it's news and that's who this guy is.
Yeah, exactly. He's a professional. Despite all the charges of unprofessionalism, there is at least some part of him that is very much professional. The whole FEC part of this storyline and campaign finance reform was neat to go back and see it being discussed here so many years before the Supreme Court ruled on Citizens United, saying that money counts as free speech. And that argument is articulated in here. Josh says,
if Big Tobacco wants to wave a sign or put a bumper sticker on their car, they are free to do so. That's free speech. Money isn't speech.
Yeah, no, he's articulating the discussion of soft money.
Yeah, it's cool. What I'm trying to say is, I like The West Wing, Josh.
I do too. It's a fine show. It really is.
I'm glad we sorted that part out, at least. It was interesting for me to hear the argument that money isn't speech so succinctly articulated in this episode.
So many years before it would be swatted away like a fly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it makes sense that a Supreme Court case had all these years building up to it, and they reference a campaign finance reform act of 1974. These are things I don't know about, but I'm learning about on The West Wing.
One of the interesting things about revisiting this show and then considering it through a lens of contemporary politics 16 years later is seeing how slow, how glacial the wheels of politics turn. And so another example in this episode is a discussion of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which policy had been instituted under President Clinton and which 11 years after this episode would be repealed. So
right.
Issues get turned and considered and brought up and padded and put aside and then revisited, and progress happens, but sometimes it's over such a long period of time, it's difficult to chart it, or it's easy to fall into that cynical thought pattern that nothing ever gets done and nothing changes. There's a certain patience you have to have, I guess, with politics.
Yeah, and I'm excited to talk about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell debate with Secretary Patrick Murphy.
How about that great sort of deus ex machina arrival of Fitzwallace into that meeting, where he just comes out and sort of lays it out in a very palpable way and exits?
Yeah. You felt like that was deus ex machina?
I thought it was, but not as a criticism.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Is that, I don't know, is that term necessarily, does it necessarily have negative connotations? I'm a fan of Greek tragedy. I enjoy a good deus ex machina. I liked that there's this relatively low-level meeting going on, and then the big cheese walks by, drops in, lays it out for them, and exits.
Yeah.
I dug that.
It is a pretty incredible exchange that he has. I love the inherent contradiction in it, because he expresses support for getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, while explicitly saying that he actually disagrees with it.
Sir, we're not prejudiced toward homosexuals.
You just don't want to see them serving in the armed forces.
No, sir, I don't.
Because they pose a threat to unit discipline and cohesion.
Yes, sir.
That's what I think, too. I also think the military wasn't designed to be an instrument of social change.
Yes, sir.
Problem with that is, that's what they were saying about me 50 years ago. Blacks shouldn't serve with whites. It would disrupt the unit. You know what? It did disrupt the unit. The unit got over it. The unit changed. I'm an admiral in the U.S. Navy and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Beat that with a stick.
It's very complicated.
Right. And the unit got over it.
Yeah, exactly.
I do like and prefer when Aaron, and he's generally pretty good about this in the show, lays out both sides.
Right.
And even when you might, you know, figure out where he comes down on the issue or where a certain character might, he substantively lays out both sides in a way where you could, you know, hook on to an argument on either side.
Right. Yeah. I think this one was particularly noteworthy for me because you've got one character doing both jobs.
Yeah, that's right.
There's one thing in that scene also that I thought was a great detail. The congressman who's in it, you know, before they actually start talking, there's a shot of him taking off his watch. I don't know if you saw this. He takes off his watch and he puts it down on the desk in front of him right before they get started. And it's a great little detail that indicates, you know, something about his attitude towards this, that he's literally counting the minutes that this is taking up on his day.
I didn't notice that detail, but that's nice.
And then it gets paid off. You might take it in, but it gets really paid off in the end when he asks Sam, is this meeting anything more than a waste of time? And Sam has to say no. And he says, okay, and everybody leaves, and you see him pick up the watch again. That's the kind of thing that I wonder, is that in the script? He takes off his watch, he picks it back up, or is that, it had to be in the script, right?
No, I would guess that's a directorial and or actor choice, but
yeah,
who knows? Maybe we can dig up the script to find out.
I wanted to talk about two more things about Fitz. One, when he leaves Leo's office and we don't actually see their meeting, but Toby comes in and he's trying to talk to Leo and he says, you know, he's asking him about what the meeting was. And Leo says that they want to put A1M1s in Manila. And Toby asks, how much does it cost? Leo says, not much, $20 billion. And just the look that Richard Schiff gives at that moment, he doesn't say anything. And it's really great. Just the length of the pause.
Yeah, I noticed that too. It's just right.
And then later, I also loved Ted Marcoux's character's, Tate's, oh my God, when Fitz comes in.
Yeah, that I thought the same thing too. That's great. It's a great delivery.
And Fitz kills it.
We haven't met.
Mike Satchel.
From Oregon.
Yes, sir.
Percy Fitz Wallace.
It's an honor to meet you, Admiral.
I imagine it would be, yes.
Not only is Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed, we're going to be talking to the Undersecretary of the Army, Patrick Murphy, who is one of the people who was most instrumental to getting it repealed. But the Secretary of the Army, Eric Fanning, is openly gay. He's the first openly gay Secretary of the Army ever. And that comes only a few years after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. It shows how much progress can happen so quickly, but also how far we've come since that moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right, particularly in light of what Fitz says in that scene. You know, he talks about just desegregating the Army, and then, you know, here I am, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Exactly.
And look at us. So it took a long time, or, you know, I guess in political terms, not so long, but 11 years after this episode before Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed. And look how far we've come.
Yeah.
Since then.
Eric Fanning is Secretary of the Army and he's openly gay. Beat that with a stick.
That's what she said.
That was my worry when I wrote it down, when I said it out loud just now.
There you go.
Following up on Josh's conversation with Jeff Breckinridge recently, and, you know, we talked about how even though Breckinridge, while talking about reparations, was very calm and collected, Josh kind of got heated on it. Here too, Josh takes the bait. Every time. If you bait him, it seems like he cannot resist. So when he has to talk about the elections commission and he calls it a fool's errand, right? He's going to talk to these senators who are on the FEC board. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I know there's Honorato is the aide to the Senate majority leader.
Right.
As played by Paul Provenza. Incredibly funny stand-up comic. I love that he does a nice little dramatic turn here.
Oh, Paul Provenza. That's Paul Provenza.
Yeah, very, very funny guy. And he makes a good, quick, indelible impression here in this scene.
Yeah.
He's a formidable foe for Josh.
Yeah, and Josh takes the bait. He said, I came in here and I knew this was nothing. I knew there was nothing that we could do here.
A fool's errand, I think he called him.
Yeah, exactly. I thought that it sounded like Mandy wrote her memo after listening to our podcast.
Interesting. Wait, why do you say that? Because it's a lot of what we've been discussing in terms of...
Yeah, in terms of where the administration is going wrong, where they're giving up the high ground, all the moments that we've noted where they have been defeated and why, or when they've given way to practical concerns over their own ideology.
Right. Which is interesting also, I found that, it's all, it's very subtle stuff and not black and white, and it's all about the gray area. And so she's written this memo about where they're weak and where they're vulnerable. And though there's a scene later on where, as you say, Josh has taken the bait and now wants to fight this FEC thing, and she's actually pushing them kind of to stay in the middle and not get into a pitched public battle about all these issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when she's working for them, she's more of a moderating influence.
Yeah.
Pushing them sometimes not to fight their idealized agenda.
That is an excellent point.
So, I mean, these are subtle things and there are inner tensions.
Yeah, you're right. She is the one who's always kind of talking about the public face and reelectability and what's going to work with the popular opinion. and it's explicitly stated in this episode that there are all these issues that the Senate Majority Leader's office might take to force them to have to stand on the unpopular side of a lot of issues. I mean, English as the national language, stuff like that, school prayer, Family Support Act, they say the Entertainment Decency Act, all these things that they know where the president stands on, and they'll bring it out in front just so that he has to look bad by stating his position. And she is very concerned with that. You're totally right. She's been the person who's been arguing against that.
Right, in a way, arguing against that memo she wrote under Russell.
This was also an interesting detail, I thought, given the context of all the things that came before, all the little political moments of compromise and failure, is this exchange between Toby and Leo.
Toby, when you start thinking about jumping ship, you'll let me know, right?
One victory in a year, Leo.
Toby.
Mendoza, we got Mendoza on the court.
This president was elected with 48% of the vote, Toby.
Yes, but he was elected.
Without a mandate, the majority of people in the country voted for somebody else.
I don't care,
this is
Leo.
New information for us, yes, that he lost the popular vote?
I think so. That's what I was like, oh, this is, we knew that it was a close election that, and that he had low approval numbers and they were struggling. But I think this is the first time maybe that it was explicitly stated that, yeah, he won without a mandate.
This is not long before before Bush would be elected without having won the popular vote.
Yeah, it's true. The circumstances of his election, though, would have been too far-fetched for a TV episode.
This is true. But they would help bring Eli Addy to the fold.
Yeah, yeah. Toby's making his point that, you know, he's like, it doesn't matter. He was elected. He was sworn in. He gets the chance to do something. But then I love that he reacts, several sentences later, back to Leo and says,
I'm not too crazy about you questioning my loyalty just then.
I don't know, that line that Donna has about why is everybody walking around here like they know they've already lost? It does. It feels like everybody is just kind of hangdog.
Right. Well, and it's all being teed up for this great scene between Leo and President Bartlett, between John Spencer and Martin Sheen. And it is a doozy. It's pretty great.
It is.
For me, it's a goosebumpy scene.
Yeah. I wanted to read you a little bit from a TV Guide article that I found about the scene and about director Laura Ennis. It was an interview that TV Guide did with Martin Sheen. He said originally that he and John Spencer were overdoing it in this scene. And then here's a quote. She let it go for about 6 or 8 takes. And then she came in and began to take all the decorations away and said, just go right to the heart and just make it personal. I saw the scene get smaller and smaller. And by the end of the evening, we were just looking at each other and talking the truth and responding. It was phenomenal what she did.
Huh. That's great.
And so I had read that before watching the episode with that in mind. I really appreciated the volume of that conflict, and I started to imagine what it would be like as a much bigger blow up, and hearing, you know, what that dialogue would be like if the tone were these guys are really, really going at it the whole time. It makes the moments where their volume does spike and the intensity gets higher really like much more dramatic.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's interesting. So it's a very astute direction, because sometimes as a film actor, over time, you need to sort of ramp up into a scene, but it's also important to take note of those times where you need to ramp down into it and where you're starting at a level you think you need to get to, but that the real scene and the real good stuff lies someplace smaller. So I guess she saw that. She was able to see that and bring them there. And it is a really focused, and I agree, very personal scene between these two.
Yeah. Do you remember this episode from when you first saw it?
Ish.
You know, like for me, I knew there are moments that I anticipate, just like I was like hungry for it. Like in this scene, especially lines when waiting for Leo to say, you drive me there. Looking at John Spencer's face, I knew what was coming. And just to see him like sort of wrestling with, is he going to say this thing? Is he, you know, the president kind of lets him off the hook. He says, we know it's not true. You don't drive me to the political safe ground. And it could be done. Leo says, I know it's not true. President Bartlett says, good. And then he starts to walk away. And Leo's just left hanging, and then he lets it out.
You drive me there.
What the hell did you say?
And you know it too.
Again, you can imagine like the whole thing being screamed, but instead it's just that moment. And then when Martin Sheen turns around and gives that with just this like flash of anger in his eyes, oh, it's so good.
Interesting. It's funny. As you describe it, it makes me wonder which is the better way to watch it. I watched it all originally back then, have not revisited it in 16 years, so I don't have anything near the level of recall that you do. So I'm seeing it almost as if for the first time, but you're able to sort of get ahead of moments and kind of watch how they're approached.
Yeah.
So we come at it from two different directions and both have their pluses and minuses. I was waiting for him to turn over his impeccably written "Let Bartlett be Bartlett." This incredibly nice handwriting.
Yeah.
Like, wow, he did that on the fly. That's the only moment I was really anticipating. I forgot also that when pushed to it, that under duress, Leo will mix his sports metaphors and say something like,
"We got our asses kicked in the first quarter, but it's time to get up off the mat."
Yes.
Which I believe is a mixed sports metaphor. I don't think wrestling has quarters.
Or boxing.
Oh, there you go. It's funny, though, that he started to indulge in sports metaphor just when I was thinking, like, oh, he's such a good coach, and this is such a sports coach moment.
Yeah, exactly. And he says, our ground game isn't working. Doesn't he say it's time to put the ball up in the air?
He references most sports. It's a little bit like an advertisement for the Olympics.
He's like, also, no gutter balls. And
the shuttlecock has been struck.
And I only want strikes, so let's serve an ace. It is pretty exciting. I mean, the energy at the end of that episode, there's a musical cue that's pretty unusual. You know, that little...
I wrote down one just that I wrote different kind of music and that it really works for me here.
I mean, we're going to lose some of these battles. And we might even lose the White House. But we're not going to be threatened by issues. We're going to put them front and center. We're going to raise the level of public debate in this country. And let that be our legacy. That sound all right to you, Josh?
I serve at the pleasure of the President of the United States.
Yeah?
I serve at the pleasure of the President.
I serve at the pleasure of President Bartlett.
Toby?
I serve at the pleasure of the President.
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons why I think it stood out so much is because normally all of the musical elements are orchestral, but this was a synthesizer. This is electronic, and you have this little electronic arpeggiated thing, this and it was pretty unusual for the palette that we've had musically. And it does, it changes things. And I felt like that was really appropriate because if things have gone a particular way, you know, since Five Votes Down, since Proportional Response, this whole idea of not being able to do stuff, if you're going to signal a sea change, why not bring in a musical element that's never been there before? I thought that was great.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's why one of the reasons why I picked this as my favorite episode of the season and thus the series thus far is that it feels like an announcement for a sea change in the show.
Yeah.
Like, we have had a season-wide story arc about the gang who couldn't shoot straight and about being pushed to the middle and about few victories, or maybe Mendoza being the only victory. And now, I don't know whether they're going to be successful or not, but they're going to, you know, they're going to go down trying kind of thing. It is an announced sea change in the series, which I welcome.
Yeah, like we've been talking about how things have been getting figured out, how the character of Sam is starting to like blossom here. Even the character of Margaret is starting to really become three-dimensional. And it feels like, all right, everything is revved up and now we can take it to the next place. And this is the announcement of that. It makes me almost feel like the first 18 episodes were like a prologue to this, like an excellent backstory to what's going to happen.
How about the "Let Bartlett be Bartlett" of it all? That harkens back to "Let Reagan be Reagan." Was that a thing?
I think when Reagan was being reelected in 1984, as they were going through the debates, there was a strategy, they said, to let Reagan be Reagan in the debates. And then I think they turned it into a slogan, and we'll put up a link. There was even a button that said, "Let Reagan be Reagan." So I'm sure that that's what this is a reference to. And I wonder now, we hear it so often in politics in the US and other countries, and in England, people use "let blank be blank." I wonder if they're referencing Reagan or if they're actually referencing the West Wing. If they know that they're referencing.
I suspect it's the West Wing.
Yeah.
Much as Aaron did wonders for the joke about the guy in the flood and the helicopter and his discussion with God.
Right.
I think that joke got a big lift from Aaron's inclusion of it.
Yeah. And so we can now blame Aaron Sorkin for the fact that we have to hear it left and right. Most recently about Mike Pence, let Pence be Pence.
That's right.
Everybody gets to be everybody. This felt like a really beautiful, classic kind of Sorkin line when Leo says,
everything you do
this morning,
everything you do says, for God's sakes, Leo, I don't want to be a one-term president.
Did I not say put our guys on the FEC?
No, sir, you did not.
Leo?
You said, no, you said, let's dangle our feet in the water of whatever the hell it is we dangle our feet in when we want to make it look like we're trying without pissing too many people off.
That's a big sentence.
Yeah.
And it takes, you understand why he works with the same actors, because it takes a particular kind of cadence and delivery to be able to pull a line like that off.
That is true. And I like that the foot dangling is used to great dramatic effect here, but it's a callback to a moment that's kind of comical in earlier in the episode.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He takes the same language that had been used kind of for a lightly comic moment and really infuses it with power and drama.
One way in which this is different from a St. Crispin's Day or a coach in the locker room kind of pep talk is that instead of clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose, we get the nerdiest version of it possible, which is, let's raise the level of debate in this country.
Yeah! Come on! Just see hordes of people just charging on a field to raise the level of debate
exactly.
In this country. Yeah, that's pretty funny.
What do you think about the very last bits of everybody repeating?
I serve at the pleasure.
Yeah.
I don't want to criticize what I feel is an incredibly great episode. It was a little much, if you're going to force me. Now you do your version. Okay. I'm going to say Bartlett. I'm going to say the president.
Right. Exactly. They all have their own.
Yeah. I wanted them maybe a little bit just after that to then each reveal their superpower.
Right. Exactly. Right.
And Toby flies away in a bolt of lightning. Yeah. Josh turns into fire.
Gimli shows up and he says,
and my axe.
And then CJ casts a Dwomer. And scene.
Yeah.
But they've earned it. For me, they've earned it. I'm all on board for this episode.
Yeah. That's...
I didn't even write it down. You forced that out of me.
I didn't write it down. I was just thinking about it.
Okay.
All right. Now we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk to Undersecretary of the Army, Patrick Murphy. And now back to the show. Joining us now is Patrick Murphy, the Undersecretary of the U.S. Army. He was a captain, he served in Iraq with the 82nd Airborne and was awarded the Bronze Star, and became the first Iraq War veteran to be elected to the House, where he represented Pennsylvania. While he was in the House, he introduced the bill that led to the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Secretary Murphy, thanks so much for joining us. What did you think about the scene in this episode where Sam and Toby are talking to the officers and congressmen about Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
I was in the Army at that time as a cadet, so I was not even an officer yet. But you look at that scene, and the military officers were basically not being very friendly and, frankly, a little aggressive toward Toby and Sam. But that was the culture, in a sense, back then, because Don't Ask, Don't Tell, or Don't Ask, Don't Tell at that time, was such a controversial thing. And it's interesting when you look back at history and through the lens of the show to kind of see that demeanor between, you know, two actors within this executive branch, obviously the military and White House staffers.
I was wondering, did you take it as a measure of the Bartlett administration's lack of seriousness about the issue that they hadn't included the chairman of the Joint Chiefs in that meeting?
I did, and it was two, you know, obviously staffers. It wasn't the vice president, it wasn't a principal to have that conversation. And so to not have the person who recommends military policy to the president, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in the room or to ask his advice was something that was a little disconcerting.
Do you think that it was an accurate portrayal of what the attitude might be to a meeting like that at that time?
I think if you're looking back at that literally 20 years ago, it could have been that contentious. But the only thing, the red flag as a military guy that struck me is you wouldn't have a major and a lieutenant colonel in that room. It would have been a full colonel or a general talking policy.
The line that I think struck me the most was when he says, those weren't our guys.
Yeah, and that was the culture. It's interesting. I remember going through air assault school as a lieutenant, you know, rappelling on helicopters and doing 12-mile ruck marches. And you know, one of the guys I was going through with, frankly, I didn't know because he didn't say it, but it was during that time before repeal, and he was quiet about his sexuality and about who he was dating, and I had no idea. And then he, you know, after graduating a really tough course, and he's a combat arms officer, basically went to his commander and said, you know, I'm not going to live a life of a lie anymore, and I'm gay. And so whether I was a captain teaching constitutional law at West Point and talking about equality and talking about how I thought the policy was wrong, even though it was the current policy, or whether I was a congressman, you know, fighting to repeal it, it was something that motivated me to try to make a change.
So can you tell us about that change? That was, so this episode aired in 2000. We're here 16 years later, and I was hoping that you could catch us up on where we are now and talk a little bit about your part in what's changed.
Sure. I mean, when I joined the Army in 1993, it was when the president at the time made a compromise with the Congress. The Congress did not want to allow gays in the military. The president did, but the compromise was a half a loaf, which was don't ask, don't tell, which meant that if you're gay, lesbian, or bisexual in the military, that you could not make any statement that you were gay, be shown in an act, or show a marriage certificate. So it was, you know, don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue. But if the word got out, or if there was photos, or you got married in a state, then that was automatically triggered. You're, you know, discharged within the military. I ran for Congress because I had lost 19 men in my unit in Iraq. I thought the war was wrong, and I came back to do something about it. And I won for Congress in suburban Philadelphia. And, you know, when I became a member of the Armed Services Committee, to recognize that for 16 years, you know, I won in 2006 and in 2007, to see that they never even had a hearing on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, to see if it was, you know, being implemented the right way or that proper oversight. So, you know, I asked my subcommittee chairwoman, Susan Davis, a great congresswoman from California, from San Diego, and I said, hey, ma'am, like, let's have a hearing on this.
And how long did that whole process take to go from, you know, your first actions against it to actually getting it repealed?
It took over a year, but I'll tell you what was very helpful was when President Obama spoke out about it at his first State of the Union address. So, you know, I became the lead sponsor on the bill. I literally went to every member in Congress, talking to them, both Democrats and Republicans. But when I had top cover, when the president said that he wanted it repealed, when members of Congress realized that if we would pass that repeal, that the president would sign it in the law, it was helpful.
And am I correct that in instituting the policy, President Clinton had argued that the compromise would help protect national security, and that part of your counter to the argument was that, in fact, in addition to it being institutionalized discrimination, but that it actually ran counter to national security to have that policy?
No doubt. I mean, listen, I've been in combat, and, you know, to see great officers and great soldiers and great airmen and Marines get thrown out of the military just because they were gay, not for any misconduct, because they were gay. And we've kicked out in a time of war since time was implemented till the end of it. But even after 9/11 happened, we kicked out over 13,000 troops.
Whoa.
Just because they were gay, because of a statement, act, or marriage, not for a misconduct. And listen, if there's misconduct, whether you're gay or straight, you should get thrown out. But just because of who they were.
One of the parts of the episode mentions that in the Uniform Code, sodomy is a crime. As part of the repeal, did you have to have that changed?
No, you know, what's interesting, so it's still a crime, but again, it's sodomy is only a crime if it goes against basically something else egregious. So it has to be something broader. It's usually tacked on, usually as part of a sex crime. But a standalone thing, it's not necessarily a crime unless it goes against the good order and discipline of a unit.
I just have one more question myself, which is, I was wondering, supporting Don't Ask, Don't Tell and pushing it through, I was wondering if you as a member of the military or as a politician, if you ended up facing any kind of negative consequences?
Well, I fought like hell to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Even though I'm straight and a combat vet and I have a wife and two little kids, but to me, I saw an injustice and I was willing to fight to change it, to fix it for the better. And I think that's what a lot of folks go in the Congress to do. And I think some folks, frankly, lose their way once they get there, once they have a taste of that power. But to me, I was willing to fight for it. And even though I only won by 0.6% by the 1,518 votes of my first race, and even though it was a 250,000 votes cast, you know, I won my reelection by 15 points. And then I got jammed up, you know, because I was pretty aggressive on Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the Affordable Health Care Act and other things that I think have changed our country for the better. But I have no regrets whatsoever. The 4 years of serving in Congress was awesome. My time and serving in the military made me the leader I am. But I think we all have our own things in our hearts that drive us. And to me, that was a pretty clear-cut one to fight for, and that's the fight for equality. And we're not all the way there yet. There's still a lot more work to do in America with transgender and some other things that, you know, I've led as Undersecretary of the Army now. With when you talk about, you know, women in combat, women in Ranger School, when you talk about transgender service, which we're implementing right now. So the long arc of equality is still happening, and it's still a fight every day.
And what about from the military? You said that during the congressional hearings, there were some members of the military who spoke in support of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Did you get any kind of blowback from your colleagues in the military, from any of the branches or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, no. Well, so, yeah, of course, some folks in the military, you know, of course, they always throw stuff. They're saying that I was gay, and that's why I was fighting for it. Other folks who said that there was my fellow paratroopers that were, you know, rolling around in their grave since one of their own is now, you know, fighting for this change. I used to do P90X in the morning with members of Congress, Paul Ryan, and a couple other guys. We'd work out in the congressional gym. I remember getting done working out, and I took a quick shower. I was rushing off to an 8 o'clock a.m. meeting, and, you know, there's a Republican member who, and I'm not trying to be partisan here, but who grabbed me in the locker room and said, "Patrick, you're going to have blood on your hands if this repeal law goes into effect. There's going to be people that are killed out there in the formations because of what you're doing."
Wow.
And I said, "Sir, with all due respect," I said, "this is a generational thing." I said, the men and women I served with in Baghdad could care less if you're gay or straight. They only care if you could carry and fire your M4 assault rifle and can you kick down a door. I was like, "So maybe your generation would have a problem with this, but my short generation sure as hell doesn't."
Huh. Well, you know, this, your real life and career parallels the main theme of this episode, which is about, as you say, what you do with power once you get it. And so I have great admiration for you, and I appreciate your joining us and your service to the country.
No, I appreciate it. Listen, it's one of my favorite episodes, the Bartlett v. Bartlett. And you know, Martin Sheen, I think, had six brothers that served in the Army, including a couple that served in Vietnam. So I've gotten to know him throughout the years. He's a great American, and I've been a huge fan of the show. In fact, I used to watch it the first two seasons at night. I was one of those members of Congress that slept in my office. So I talked to my wife and kids who were still back in Pennsylvania. I talked to them on the phone about 9 o'clock. We'd hang up, and I'd watch an episode or two before I hit the rack with my little air mattress in Congress. It's a very glamorous life when you're a member of Congress, let me tell you. But, guys, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I had a blast. And if I could ever be helpful, you let me know.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. And that's it for our episode. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.
In the meantime, check out the official West Wing Weekly lapel pin. If you follow us on Twitter or Facebook, you've probably already seen it, but if not, go to thewestwingweekly.com/pin to check it out.
You can show the world your love for The West Wing and for The West Wing Weekly by wearing our first ever piece of merch. Yes, merch. It's a 1-inch brass and enamel pin with our logo, the White House, and 7 stars for the 7 days of the week and for the 7 seasons of the show.
And across the top, it says, "What's next?" So check it out at thewestwingweekly.com/pin and pick one up for yourself or for your favorite West Wing Weekly fan.
You will be supporting our show and looking good while doing it.
And if you have comments or questions, or if you want to discuss this episode with us or other West Wing Weekly listeners, you can leave a comment at thewestwingweekly.com or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly.
You can also find us and follow us on Twitter, at West Wing Weekly. Plus, I'm at Josh Molina. Rishi is at Rishi Hirway. Rishi starts with an H, by the way. And Undersecretary Murphy is at USA Murphy.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Mm-hmm. Radiotopia.